This is the Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Reed Quinn, serial entrepreneur and founder of KT Tape and FiberFix. As we chat, the Summer Olympics in Rio are but 9 months away. If this Olympics is like the last one, we in the audience are likely to see the world's best athletes sporting brightly colored tapes on their thighs, their shoulders, and even on their buttocks. This tape is known as kinesio tape, and its fans are convinced that it helps with sports injury recovery. KT Tape is one of the leaders in this market. They're based in Linden, Utah, and was started by Reed Quinn and other family members in 2008. Their other product, FiberFix, was featured on Shark Tank and is sold in thousands of hardware stores across the nation. Reed, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having me.
I gave a little bit of a description. I think people can recall seeing brightly colored tape on world-class athletes. But tell us what KT Tape does.
So we manufacture and distribute a stretchy, sticky athletic tape that prevents speed recovery and helps athletes perform at their peak.
And it's primarily to recover from injuries or injury prevention?
It's used for both, but I'd say that it's probably 80-20, that most people that are wearing it actually have an injury, or maybe they've had an injury in the past and they don't want to have that same mishap again.
And as I did a little bit of background research, the first real public information on KT Tape that I was able to find was in 2009. You guys were in a BYU competition, the New Venture Championship. You guys came in first place. How did KT Tape start? Was it right around 2009? Or I know it was featured, there were some athletes in the 2008 Olympics that were wearing it.
Yeah, so the tape was actually invented by a Japanese guy named Kenzo Kase almost 30 years ago. And it was kind of used in Japan and used at very high levels for athletes all around the world. If you go back to Lance Armstrong, for example, has a book, Every Second Counts, and talks about this magic pink tape from Japan that they'd put on, and it would just make his sore muscles disappear. And but it was only really kind of a secret used by these A-level athletes. And I saw it the same time that the rest of the world saw it, which was when Olympic gold medalists Kerry Walsh and Misty May were competing for their first Olympic gold medal. And MSNBC spent about 10 minutes during that match talking about kinesiology tape. They said, "What is that on her shoulder? Is that a tattoo?" "No, it's covering a tattoo." "No, she had surgery and that's helping her recover, and it's called kinesiology tape." And you know, being in consumer products at that time, I remember going to Google Trends, you know, where you can see what people are searching for on the internet, and I remember seeing that number one was kinesiology tape and number two was Michael Phelps. And that never happens with a product, especially one that people don't know anything about. And having just exited another business, looking for something to do, and got together with some of my coworkers from the previous business that were also looking for a new gig. And we started to research the product and improve the product. And that's kind of how the whole thing started. It was just seeing it in the Olympics, recognizing the opportunity, and then adapting what was really a medical product for a consumer market and everything that goes with that.
In fact, you guys got a patent for that, right, to really target it towards the general public.
Correct. So, you know, it was designed by doctors for doctors, and the principles of kinesiology are very sound, but they're not very easy to understand. You need to kind of understand anatomy. The tape was in one long, sticky, stretchy mess that was hard to cut, and consumers weren't going to have scissors in their gym bag. And so I made some very elementary changes in terms of pre-cutting the tape and, you know, changing the color and branding it and getting the right roll size and pricing. But then we made some really pretty you know, in the first year of the business, as we really understood how the tape works and relieves pain, and said, "Hey, there's a lot that we could do with this. Instead of these little skinny cores that run out of elasticity very quickly. We need to make that bigger, but that's going to make it thick. Well, then how do we make it thin? Well, let's take the fibers that are on the outside and switch those from cotton to synthetic. So we ended up with design patents, manufacturing patents, utility patents, you know, a lot of innovation around that product. But it was based on the research and the innovation from 30 years before that was specifically for the medical industry.
And you've got to be careful. I mean, the FDA, rightfully so, carefully regulates this, and you have to be careful what you say and what it can do so that you're not classified as a medical product. I'm guessing if you're sold on the shelves in sporting goods stores, you're not classified as a medical product.
So we are. There's three classes of medical devices that the FDA regulates, and we are in the least regulated of those classes, but it is a medical device. And you have to register with the FDA and comply to their regulations. But it's not a really onerous hurdle for that lowest level of medical device classification.
Interesting. And speaking of targeting consumers versus physicians and versus physical therapists, I noticed in some of the research, like you have packages for, if you have tennis elbow, here is the tape package for that.
Most of our products are very generic, and it's really how you apply them, you know, that determines, you know, how much you stretch them, where you anchor them, you would tape a knee injury. That is your patella tendonitis, different than a meniscus or an IT band, even though they're all knee-related injuries, the causes for them and then the treatments for them and the way that you tape them are different. So it's not so much that the tape is customized to the injury as the way that you apply it is customized to the injury. So.
Got it. Which means that the consumer's got to be educated.
Correct.
On how to apply it. You started in this business 2008, 2009. You know, today, streaming video on the internet, just about all of us can do that from our homes. Back 2008, 2009, it was probably half of us could do that, the other half could not. Yeah. How did you educate consumers back then, and how do you do it today?
So, you know, when we originally looked at the business, there was basically five go, no-go criteria, you know, not having a background in a medicine or in kinesiology. I said, first, we've got to make sure that there's efficacy. There's we've got to be able to tap into this interest in the product. We have to, and one of them was the consumer education criteria, and that really came down to choosing the right consumers to go after. We could have chose to go after geriatrics, people who are sore all the time and have chronic injuries. We could have gone after pediatrics. But we chose to go after athletes. As far as building a brand. What is a really good foundation is kind of emotional engagement. And there are very few consumer product categories better than sporting goods to get people passionate about. And when they're passionate, they're willing to spend a little bit more time. They're willing to, put a little bit more effort into the buying process and the decision making. They're a little bit easier to be swayed by influencers, you know, people who they respect and admire and are leaders and trendsetters in their sport. And so, we did know that we had that hurdle, and we tried to stack the deck at least a little bit in our favor by going after that very passionate sports market.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Reed Quinn, entrepreneur and founder of KT Tape and FiberFix. When you're an athlete, a weekend athlete, and you're nursing an injury, and as I get older, that happens more and more often to me, unfortunately. You're right. You are willing to spend the time that it takes to figure out, okay, what can I do so I can still do my workouts while I'm injured. In addition, we're heavily influenced. We have our favorite leaders in our industry, in our sports, and we like to follow them. You know, the nice thing for you is these athletes were already wearing this tape. People were already searching Google. People were already seeing them on television. You couldn't afford to buy that type of coverage.
Correct. There were really two primary marketing strategies that we had early on, and one of them was kind of the passive, taking advantage of the PR and the interest in the product. Some of that was kind of left over from the Olympics, and some of it was, kind of generated as we started to get out there, and athletes that were in the public eye were wearing the tape without, us paying them to wear the tape. Their trainers and were putting it on, or they were finding it themselves. The other one was very active, and that was an event marketing strategy. We kind of had the idea that, we need – people are very skeptical about kinesiology tape until they've tried it. It's very intuitive when they see a brace or something like that, how it works, right? I can tell it's going to take some pressure off, and it's going to support my knee, and okay, I get it. But how does a couple grams of tape really do the same thing, or in a lot of cases, do more for me? It's just not intuitive. But as soon as we put the tape on them, we would have a customer. So that was the first step. We identified very early on that to generate trial was to convert somebody. And if they had never tried it, it was placebo. It was skepticism.
That's how I came across your tape, actually. There was an event in Park City, and there was somebody there that had the tape and would put it on. You're like, I don't know why it works. It just does.
Yeah. As soon as we had identified that trial was really what was converting people, the first strategy was, okay, well, we've got to get samples of this tape in everybody's hands. And so, we said, where do lots of athletes congregate, and hopefully lots of injured athletes? And it turns out that marathons is a great place, because just getting your body ready for that marathon distance, you're going to get something. You're going to get patella tendonitis or plantar fasciitis or shin splints. And, most of these races will have a race kit, some type of a bag that comes with a goodie bag and a race number or something that you put in your shoe that tracks your time. So our first thought was, let's put a sample of this product into the race bag, and it'll be inexpensive and people can try it, and then we can track. We'll put a little code on the back, and if they want more, they can go on and use this code and get free shipping on their first order or something, so that we can really track the response. And we had it worked out so that it was going to be, we need 2% of these people who get our kits to go on and try this and then purchase it to break even, and it ended up being about 0.25%. I said, well, that didn't work. But in paying to put these little sample pieces of tape into the race kits, we got booths at some races. I think our first marathon was actually here in Salt Lake. And we went to and it was surprising, because we actually made more money taping people up, explaining how to use it, and then selling them tape to cover all the expenses. And that became our primary strategy, was to go to marathons. Any marathon over 15,000 people will have a presence there, not just marathons, but triathlons and relay races and Tough Mudders. And also we did over 400 events last year. And we're creating these great groups of users that then go back to their running groups, go back to the communities and say, oh, I ran the Boston Marathon. I came across this awesome product. I stood in line for 2 hours to get taped up, but I would not have made it through the race without it. You got to try this stuff. And, we really have kind of taken a really good position as a brand with that demographic.
I love that story. I mean, there's a phrase in the startup world, initially you have to do things that don't scale. And as you tell me this story, I'm thinking, it's great that this is how you built your initial momentum, but how do you go from there and continue the growth trajectory that you want to be on? And it sounds like this has remained a key core part of your marketing and your sales strategy.
Yeah, there's lots of things that we do to help with consumer education adoption. We have online forms. We have our instructional videos, which have been viewed, over 100 million times.
That's what I was expecting you to say. We educate people. We sell people via YouTube.
Hmm. Yeah, that's definitely part of it, but it's a whole strategy. PR is part of the strategy. The event marketing is part of the strategy. The YouTube videos is part of the strategy. We actually have a really good community where the community is as much helping answer other people's questions as we are. And, you know, we have high engagement, Facebook, Twitter.
I can see that this would be the type of product that people love. They become what's called raving fans. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Reed Quinn, entrepreneur and founder of KT Tape and FiberFix. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Reed Quinn, entrepreneur and founder of KT Tape and FiberFix. So I mentioned the BYU competition 2009, actually. And your cousin, Michelle, I believe, is the one that opened that presentation. She wisely chose to open it with a video of Kerry Walsh, I believe, and her team winning the Olympic gold during the Beijing Olympic. It's an emotional moment. Your audience gets tied into it. They cheer afterwards. Ironically, though, if I'm right, Kerry was actually a spokesperson for your competitor at the time. That changed shortly after that.
Well, she wasn't a spokesperson for any brand of kinesiology tape. You know, we don't actually know what brand she was wearing. There are several.
The Wall Street Journal says she was working for your competitor. So at the time, during the 2008 Olympics.
So one of our go, no-grow criteria was to contact Kerry and see if we could use her name and image on the packaging. And, you know, as far as we know, and her agent and she informed us, was that she does have sponsorships. She's sponsored by Speedo. She's sponsored by Gatorade. She's sponsored by a lot of companies. But Kinesio USA was not one of them, which was the only U.S. kinesiology tape at the time. And in fact, we contacted Kinesio right at the beginning thinking that, hey, if they've already got this product and they're manufacturing it or they're importing it, maybe, you know, we could partner with, we could help them get this into retail. And they were very against retail distribution of the product. What their business model revolved around was education by physicians. So what they would do is they'd invite a physician out to their three-day seminar, and they would, you know, have them purchase medical education from it. At the end, they would get a certificate. And selling of kinesiology tape and scissors and other supplies to these doctors was kind of the secondary market for these guys. So they weren't really doing any consumer-facing athlete promotion. Kerry Walsh simply had an injury. A medical doctor put it on her shoulder. It helped, and she kept wearing it.
Yeah, actually, as I hear you say this, I stand corrected. I think what they said was she was wearing the tape from your competitor at the time, which makes sense
because
you
weren't in the business. Well, we didn't exist. Exactly.
Yeah, you weren't in the business at the time. Okay. So you approached this other company that was the leader at the time. They said, hey, we're not interested in going after the consumer market. I know during your initial presentation, your idea to market this to the world was really to partner up with a group called SCG, Sports Consulting Group. How did that work? And ultimately, how did you decide to switch to the strategy that you're doing today?
I don't remember SCG. It's been quite a few years, but, you know, I do remember some things in the business plan. We thought that team sports was going to be a really big market for us. I kind of identified three markets. Okay, we're going to go after consumers, we're going to go after doctors that want to put these on patients, and we're going to go after teams, and we're going to sell it to teams. Well, it turns out that teams are very decentralized, and buying decisions are made sometimes at the school district level, and sometimes, and teams really are consumers, largely. I mean, there's a very small percentage that are professional teams and have budgets for disposable medical items, but their team doctors make those decisions, and so they're in the doctor category. So there really didn't exist a third category. I wonder if SGS was one of these distributors that we had thought
of. Yeah, they had relationships with colleges, high schools, and club teams.
That makes sense, because I remember being shocked, kind of as we explored that and we tried to make team sales, that there just wasn't a market there. There was, however, a smaller clinical market than we thought, and a bigger consumer market. In 2008, so kinesiology tape is not made in the U.S. It's made in Japan, Korea, and China.
Even today?
Okay. Ours is made.
Why is that?
U.S. manufacturing is
it's because woven products aren't made in the U.S. Is that?
And that's this
is
a big product. Part of it. Yeah. You know, the equipment that you need is used for other products that are manufactured outside the U.S. But because it's manufactured outside the U.S. and imported, there's public records. There's import documentation, commercial invoices, packing lists. So we could get a very accurate idea of the size of the kinesiology tape market in 2008, who was importing it, how much they were importing, all that's public record.
And I was pretty surprised at how big it was back then. During the presentation, you share that number as well.
Yeah, I think it was right around about 100,000 rolls. Was, you know, as we go back and look at the data, if I'm remembering correctly.
And what's the size of the market today?
It's something around 4 or 5 million rolls a year. And 95% of that market is the consumer market, not the medical market. So it's interesting that it originated and was used as a medical product. But as soon as we empowered customers to apply it themselves, there was a much bigger opportunity that was just under the surface.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Reed Quinn, entrepreneur and founder of KT Tape and FiberFix. So when you and your family got into the business, it was 100,000 rolls of this tape was being sold a year. Now it's in the millions. You guys had a patent, at least in the U.S., giving you exclusive rights to sell it directly to consumers. Did that patent hold up, or I'm guessing some of the big guys said, wait a minute, you know, we're going to try to go after that patent?
So the patent was really on the improvements that we made on the tape, not on kinesiology tape itself. So the consumer version of the tape is really the pre-cut version of the tape, the version that is on a roll and is perforated so that you can
So you have the rights to the pre-cut?
Correct. Okay. And then all of the innovations with the synthetic and the reflective properties and the things that we did as we saw how consumers were using it and how to improve the product, you know, there's been some innovations on that. But those have never been challenged. You know, patents, I think.
Not even challenged, I'm surprised.
Well, I think why it's because you have a portfolio. I mean, our strategy with patents is to, you know, continually innovate and make sure that there's more than
build
one.
Build up that moat.
Yeah. Patents, when they go to litigation, it's like a coin toss. About 50% of them are upheld and 50% are struck down. Now, if we only have one coin toss, maybe you are willing to challenge it. But if I get six chances to, you know, get one of them upheld, then it might it's very unlikely that if you knock us off exactly that you're not going to get caught on something. So
it's a smart strategy. And it's obviously it sounds like it's worked very well for you. So during this presentation, you know, it's kind of fun. I do some angel investing both personally and through my company. And we hear these lofty projections all the time. And you and Michelle shared your projections where you thought you'd be in 4 years. You probably don't remember what that projection was. I'll share it with you. I'm not asking you to. You guys are privately held. You probably don't release your sales. I'm not asking you to share with us your sales numbers. But just give me, did you guys blow it out of the water or did it take longer? So your projections for year four, so four mm-hmm. years after that, were that you'd be a $35 million a year in sales company.
Those were very high. Okay. So I think that we ramp slower, but we also probably you know, have a much higher peak than we originally anticipated. There seems to be a larger opportunity. It's taking longer to get there. But, you know, we stumbled on a product category that can grow into a similar size to insoles, shoe insoles or white athletic tape or, you know, as we've seen the way that this grows and continues to grow even in year six now, it's obvious that there's still a long way to go.
Okay. Well, that's a good note for us to transition onto the other business that you're in. We may come back to KT Tape, but this is a good place for us to transition. I believe I mentioned in the open, you and one of your other family members was on Shark Tank, I think a couple years ago now, not for KT Tape, but for a product FiberFix. Tell us what FiberFix does.
So FiberFix is what we call a rigid repair wrap. It's like if you've ever had a broken bone and you go to the doctor and he puts a cast on it. It comes in an airtight pouch, and it's soft and flexible like tape. But as soon as you take it out of the pouch, it starts to absorb the moisture out of the air, and within about 5 minutes, it's hard as a rock. And the idea, similar to KZ tape, was a medical tape that had a much bigger consumer application. And, you know, if instead of repairing a broken bone, couldn't you use something similar to that to repair a broken shovel, a broken pipe, a broken tent pole, you know, just about anything that you can wrap that breaks.
And it sounds like you followed a similar playbook. Right, this was a medical product. You said, hey, there's an application in the consumer space. As you describe it, it's obvious that, yes, that would be an application. Probably wasn't so obvious day one, though. How did you guys go from here's the medical application to wrapping my PVC pipe that might have a crack in it?
Well, yeah. In fact, the attributes of our product are almost exactly opposite of what you would want in a medical product. In a medical product, when they wrap an arm, they want it porous. They want it strong, but they want the sweat to be able to evaporate, you know, as you wear this for weeks. If they want to check and see how that bone's healing, they want to be able to take an x-ray. So they want it porous. They want it not very dense. They don't want it very sticky. They don't want it sticking to the patient's clothes or the doctor's hands. You know,
sounds like awful medical tape. What did they use it for?
For casts. I mean, regular medical casting tape, you know, there was some really old plaster of Paris stuff, but, you know, for the last couple decades, it's been fiberglass with water-activated pre-impregnated resin. And so all we kept was the fiberglass pre-impregnated resin. And we said, we've got to make this a different length. We've got to make it much more dense. We've got to make it watertight. We've got to make the resin really sticky. It's got to bear loads. It's got to withstand impact. It can't be brittle like casting tape. It's going to be permanent, where casting tape is meant to be, you know, kind of temporary. And so took that original concept and said, let's change a few things about this. Let's increase the density of the weave. Let's change the resin. Let's work with this, and very quickly had a product that really has a high wow factor, where you can take something that was that was broken and make it stronger than it was before it was broken.
So, is this something you're doing with your? I mentioned Michelle, your cousin, was your co-founder at KT Tape. She mentioned that you and your family had worked together in a previous company and had a successful exit. I'm wondering what the Quinn family is like around the table. Were you guys playing with this tape for weeks, or is your family really into this inventing mode? Or take us into the Quinn family. What's it like?
Sure. The Quinn family is an awesome family. It's a big family. I have my grandma and grandpa live in Bountiful, Utah, and have 12 children and 60-some grandchildren.
Wow.
So I have a lot of cousins that are my same age or a little bit younger, and they're very bright and they're hardworking. And you know, there's a couple ways to really get a business started. There's one where you can go out and raise money and hire the right people, you know, with the right experience, or you can really put in a lot of sweat equity. And each time I've chosen to put in sweat equity, but I've known that it isn't something that I can do on my own. And so I've either got to find somebody that is a known entity that I'm comfortable with working. I know their work ethic. I know their skill set. I know that I can go into business with this person and be happy. And so far, it's worked out beautifully. Sometimes that's been family members. Sometimes it's been former coworkers or friends or associates. And that's the other thing that I like to do is when I start a business is to get some really good partners, some partners that have different skill sets than I have, that have strengths where I have weaknesses, and that bring a lot of different types of experience to the table. So with KT Tape, you know, really the founders of KT Tape were myself, my brother-in-law, Ryan Dewey, and two of my co-workers from a previous consumer product business, C-Stone, Jim Jensen and John McKay. I was going to the nighttime MBA program, and I had a cousin going to the daytime MBA program. And Michelle is very bright. I am a horrible speller and proofreader. She is a very good technical writer. She did. She worked with MSNBC. And I approached her when I was at her house at Thanksgiving and said, hey, I'm going to go try and do this business plan circuit. And as a graduate student, you know, I...
You were at BYU or at the U?
I was at BYU. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, we did participate at University of Utah Business Plan Competition at BYU and at Wake Forest and at University of Oregon and at San Diego State. We did the whole circuit around the country to all these graduate business plan competitions. So I said, I need another person in these presentations to come with me that is a good presenter, that's intelligent, that's smart. And so I kind of recruited her, and she said, okay, well, I'm only involved for these business plans. And I said, it's fine. I think it'll be a good experience. And in 2008, the bottom fell out of the economy, and she had two offer letters that were rescinded. And she said, you know, I'd like to stick around and do this. And so she did for about 2 years. And, you know, and she, her, she married and her husband moved and she continued to work remotely.
They videotaped your presentation, which is where I got all this information from.
Sure. So, yeah, but, even now with FiberFix, my partners at FiberFix are my brother, Christopher Quinn, my cousin, Spencer Quinn, my cousin-in-law, Derek Rowley, who married one of my cousins, and one of the former C-Stone guys, Eric Child. And so, again, all known entities, all great guys, hard workers, skills that are complementary and different from mine. And it helped, you know, really launch these businesses quickly without a lot of outside capital.
Yeah, no, it's, you're fortunate to have that situation. Having the right co-founders to choose from, that's one of the biggest, as you know, decisions that you make as a founder. And I think it's really smart that you go with people that you know. You reduce your risk by doing that. It's also family. You know, you mentioned recruiting Michelle at Thanksgiving dinner, and in this case, it worked out. You know, not all businesses do work out, and that can make for an awkward Thanksgiving the following year. How do you think about internally balancing that potential risk?
That's a really good question. A lot of people have asked me about that because I keep doing it. And as long as it continues to be very successful, I will probably continue to do it. But really, I think it's just like anything that is going to have lasting impact, you need to take a really long time kind of think about and considering from lots of different aspects, you know, before you make those decisions. Same thing happens when we find a supplier in China. You know, some people will search on Alibaba, pick a supplier and you know, wire them some money and hope to get the product that works. Well, that's a little bit like going to an online dating site and marrying the first girl that, you know, responds to a message. And it could work out. It's possible. It's not likely. And so, you know, you need a courtship. You need a period of time to get to know each other, to really understand what people bring to the table. And then you make sure that they are taken care of and that they are included and that they are respected. And it has worked out beautifully.
I'm glad to hear that. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Reed Quinn, entrepreneur and founder of KT Tape and FiberFix. You mentioned treating folks with respect, taking care of them, being inclusive. And one of the things that was impressive to me is as I looked at the videotape from the BYU competition, as I looked at the follow-up from the Shark Tank presentation, you were not presented as the key person. You were there. But you were the second person. In Shark Tanks, at least in the follow-up, you know, where are they 6 months later video, Spencer was the one that was highlighted. In the BYU presentation, Michelle is the one that opened the presentation, which is unusual for an entrepreneur.
It's not unusual for me. Both Michelle and Spencer are better presenters than I am. I have no, need to be out there in the limelight trying to you know, for me, the success of the business is the most important thing. And why would you not put your best resource forward, you know?
The reason I think a lot of folks don't is they have a potentially fragile ego, and they think they need that, they're that person, and they need to do it. I think it's a I think it's a powerful compliment to you that you don't feel the need to do that.
Well, thank you.
I can tell you, Steve Jobs would have never done that. But as we all know, it took a lot of people with Steve Jobs to create a company like Apple. It takes a lot of people to do the things that you're doing successfully as well.
Well, and the other thing that I really hope is that people that I work with, you know, I may move on and work on another venture and step back. And those are going to be the leaders. Those are going to be the people that stay with it, that need to feel like they're vested. Also, with both Spencer and Michelle, they will be involved in other ventures. They will go off and do great things, and I would love to participate in those. And if I've given them great opportunities to kind of grow and develop and get out and spread their wings, how can that not come back? So it's not completely altruistic. I really do think that, you know, if you plan for the long term, then, you know, every good deed comes back to you eventually. So
it's a good philosophy. And, you know, we're on the radio, so people don't see, but you're a young man. I mean, I'm guessing you're late 20s, early 30s at the most.
I'm 35. So
35. Okay. You've done a lot in a very short period of time. Did you always think you'd be an entrepreneur? We were talking about your family earlier. You mentioned your grandparents up in Bountiful. Were they entrepreneurs?
You know, there are, in a large family, a healthy mix. There's doctors and lawyers. There's entrepreneurs and accountants. My grandfather was in the Army and then was an engineer and did start his own business in storage systems. And several of my uncles grew up working in that business. Entrepreneurship for me was a decision that came as a result of another decision. Originally, I served a mission in Taiwan. I learned Mandarin Chinese. I felt very strongly that I wanted to be involved in that part of the world. I wanted to, and if you're working in China, it's going to be products. And if you want to have control over those products, then you've got to learn retail and retail distribution and product development and product innovation. And entrepreneurship came very naturally from there. I moved to China right after school, worked there for a year for a tech transfer for a composite boat building company, came back to the U.S. and was working for a startup that was doing consumer products manufacturing in China, designing and distributing and selling in the U.S. And, you know, I really liked the business model. I saw a lot of business models in China that I didn't gravitate towards. I thought, this is not what I want to do. But that one, as soon as I saw it, I said, yeah, that's really kind of what I want to do going forward. So,
you know, earlier in the interview, you mentioned a company, I believe you called it Seastone.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your first venture?
It was. You know, that was where I gained a lot of experience with product development, manufacturing, and retail.
And was this the family exit that Michelle mentioned?
No family members involved in that one. It was a company that created gift card accessories, the gift card market.
I didn't know there were accessories for gift cards.
Oh, it was envelopes, boxes, tins, little animals that holds the gift cards. Gift cards were just taking off, and we started to put together programs. Gift cards is the single largest retail category. It's more ubiquitous than electronics or apparel or food.
It's because people like me, I get them for a gift, and then it's like, what happened to that gift card?
Yeah, there are
and
lots
Best
of
Buy
reasons.
Just got 50 bucks for free.
Yeah, there's lots of reasons why retailers like gift cards, but, you know, a lot of consumers don't like gift cards because it's impersonal. It's a financial transaction. But if we can actually put together a gift with purchase, an offering, a box, something that you put some thought in, you said, you know, this is how I'm presenting it. This is how, I want to enhance the experience. And it really took off, that business. I spent 5 years there and had a very similar trajectory to KT Tape and FiberFix, and got a chance to really kind of cut my teeth before I went off and did it on my own.
Yeah, and that sounds like a more forgiving business than maybe some of your latter businesses. I think execution much more important than what you're doing, is what I'm visualizing. I don't know if I'm right or not.
It was exactly that. It was a much simpler business model. Gift cards, 80% of them are sold between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and so it's not an everyday item to have a gift card program with accessories and things. It's more of a seasonal item, so that means no inventory, no brand. If it was Walmart gift card program, it looked like Walmart. If it was Cafe Rio's, it looked like Cafe Rio. And so we were using creative, often from the retailers, and the whole business model was simpler. Not a lot of consumer education, not a lot of branding and marketing.
Which I think is important for entrepreneurs, right? Start with something that's not as complex. What you're doing now is very complex. Retail is hard. Doing it right. I mean, on Shark Tank, you guys make it look easy. But the reality is retail is really hard.
Well, and what is nice about it is that it continues to get more complicated. We continue to find more and diverse ways to promote the product, and the merchandising gets more complicated. And the business model itself, with FiberFix, a big difference from KT Tape was that in sporting goods, there are maybe 10 national sporting goods, Sports Authority, Dick's, Big Five, Hibbett, Dunham, Sports Chalet, Academy, they're all going to be very large customers. In hardware, there's two. There's Home Depot, and then there's Lowe's. And that is a lot of risk when one of those customers decides to order big or order small or doesn't know what they're going to do next year. And to only have that, to have that type of customer concentration. Menards is a very distant third as a national hardware. But there is a huge independent hardware market. Ace, True Value, Orgill, Do It Best, Handy Hardware, they all have thousands of locations, but they're all individually owned. And that means every individual store owner decides whether or not they want to bring in your product. There may be 100,000 products available to them through the Ace warehouse, but only, they only bring in maybe 1,500 or 1,700, no more than 2,000 per hardware store. So that's only 2% of the available products. Well, how do you get into every single one of those hardware stores? So I had to drastically change the business model and get good at things that we never even thought about at KT Tape, because we just had a very different customer base. So even though it was retail, even though it was manufacturing in China, even though it was U.S. design and product development and IP, and a lot of the things were similar, there are definitely things that
I'm exhausted just thinking of all the things you've got to be good at, which is, the challenge for entrepreneurship. It really is, in many respects, an impossible job. And I think you were wise to kind of incrementally increase your skills and take on more and more complex situations. Let me ask you, because one of the things about C-Stone, while it's from an execution standpoint simpler, It, unless I'm missing something, it did not tie into one of your passions, which was working in China.
It did.
And how did it, okay, so
so the first year for C-Stone, I think I went to China 9 times, some of them for a few days, some of them for a month. All of our manufacturing, we used to say that we did everything but glass, and then we started doing glass. So
so much for that.
Corrugate, wood, plastic, injection molding, thermal form, rotor gravure printing, any type of manufacturing. We would have to put together a program for a retailer, and that retail, it might have 26 SKUs, it might have 26 different products, some on the high end, some in the middle, some on the low end, made of all these different things. We made elaborate boxes that were like music boxes that you'd open and make sound. We had some that looked like little mini wooden sleds, and the gift card just kind of slid in there, and they were an ornament or a decoration.
So that was perfect. You were able to tie in the love for China as well as a simpler business.
And that was why they recruited me.
As a reminder, if you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Reed Quinn, entrepreneur, founder of KT Tape and FiberFix, and also a past participant on Shark Tank, which has gotten a lot of publicity. A lot of folks that aren't in the startup scene, that don't do investing, that probably don't really have a burning desire to become an entrepreneur. It's a really interesting show, I think, for the public. Frankly, my sister in Cleveland, Ohio, is the one that told me about Shark Tank, probably like season 3. I'd never heard of it. And she asked me, you must love Shark Tank. And I'm like, what is Shark Tank? I mean, it's really been, a surprise hit. And because of that, a lot of people in the audience, I think, are interested in what that experience is really like. So when were you on Shark Tank, and how did that come to be?
So we went on in October of 2013. It came to be, I was at a church activity, and we had just moved into a new area, and I was talking with somebody that I'd never met before in the same place in line and next to me. And he happened to be a professor of entrepreneurship out at Virginia Tech. And so we started talking about entrepreneurship, and then I told him a little bit about this new startup that I was working on called FiberFix. And he said, "You should go on Shark Tank." And I said, "What is Shark Tank?"
So I don't feel so bad. You hadn't heard of it either.
I had not heard of it. And he said, "Well, it's this show and people go on, and it's got 8 million viewers." And I said, "Yeah, that might be kind of fun." But he could tell that I was not going to do anything about it. And he said, "I'm going to write to them and I'm going to get you on Shark Tank." And I said, okay. And I had kind of forgot about it. And then 3 weeks later, he wrote me back and said, "Hey, they responded to me and they're done filming for this season, but they'll start filming again in a few months for the next season." And I was kind of surprised that he had remembered and followed through on his word. And he said, "If I get you on Shark Tank, will you donate, and it was something like 10 cents on, for every dollar of product that you sell in the first year?" And I said, yeah, sure.
It sounds like a professor of entrepreneurship.
Yeah. He's a great guy. And true to his word, he kept hounding Shark Tank, and they said, "This sounds really interesting. We have some questions for you. How many retailers are they in? How long have they been in business?" And he said, "I don't know the answers to any of these questions. You really got to talk to Reed." And so he called me and said, "Okay, this guy from casting at Shark Tank is going to be calling you." And I was just about to get on a plane. I almost got kicked off the plane because I was still talking to him when the stewardess started giving me dirty looks. But they asked some questions about the business. Hey, this seems really interesting. So we kind of skipped the casting process. I guess there's auditions or
they were
pitches.
Here,
or,
yeah, in the spring, and they gave at the University of Utah, and they only gave the kids like 30 seconds to pitch their company. It's like, how do you pitch your company in 30 seconds?
So from that standpoint, we really can't take a lot of credit for it.
You just went right on the air? They didn't cast you first?
No, no, no. What they did is they asked us, they said, "Well, hey, we think this is very interesting. We're going to put you on a short list. Can you send us a video?" I said, "What kind of a video?" "Well, I want you to talk for 2 or 3 minutes about the company, make it energetic, And so we sent in the video, and very quickly we were talking about a pitch and a script, and we're scheduling a time to go out with ABC a couple months later. And even once you go out, sometimes, you don't film. And even if you film, sometimes you don't go on the air. So we always kind of looked at it as just this possibility. It's probably worth to continue going down the path and pursue this. But we never, that was never part of the primary strategy. We're going to get on Shark Tank and we're going to do a deal with a shark and make sure that everybody knows what FiberFix is. No, it was more kind of reactive to, the opportunity, and it ended up being a really big windfall. I mean, a real blessing for us.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because one of the sharks came on board, people that watch Shark Tank, Lori, who's with QVC. Mm-hmm. I saw in the little promo video that immediately after it aired, you were on QVC, obviously sold a lot of your tape that day. But what was it, outside of that immediate bump, what was it like going forward?
Well, there's probably, like you said, an immediate bump, but also kind of a residual user base, people that did get the product, that liked the product, that talked to their neighbors over the fence about the product, and we continue to benefit from that. I estimate that it probably shaved off about a a year to a year and a half of our ramp time. You know, we were at the same place, 6 months after Shark Tank, where we had been running the business for about a year and a half at that point, as we would have been at 2.5 or maybe even 3 years.
It's really valuable.
It's extremely valuable. You know, we were, for example, testing with Home Depot in 200 locations, and we were having conversations with Lowe's, and they were kind of, we're thinking maybe Q1 of next year doing a test, and all of a sudden it was, let's roll this out to all locations, and let's give you the Innovation Tower, kind of a really sought-after retail location in the store, which we probably wouldn't have had the opportunity for at least another year or two. I mean, after you do a test order and it sells well, then maybe you go in line and then maybe you're eligible for a promotion. We kind of, again, skip to the front of the line because, hey, this is hot now and people are going to be looking for it in Lowe's, especially with to be able to use a Shark Tank follow-up to kind of highlight that Lowe's program. And so, there continues to be, some positive externalities that have come out of Shark Tank. Lori, we continue to have a good relationship with her and talk with her frequently. And she's introduced us to other of her entrepreneurs. It's been a really rewarding relationship.
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, just a fun question. Did you have one of those hokey openers that they always have on Shark Tank? I'm thinking of one, rigid fiber fix, let's stop the leak and build a gusher of a business.
It was as hokey as can be. And what you're really trying to do is be entertaining, right? ABC cares about it for the entertainment. The sharks actually do care about the investment opportunity. You care about...
it's a business. It's a real business for you.
But, you can go and film and, you can argue about valuations or you can... And it doesn't make for very good television. But if you have a compelling pitch and a story and a product that people can relate to and get emotionally engaged with, then you're much more likely to get on air. So, I think our TV personalities that came across are a little bit more energetic and maybe even a little more obnoxious than our regular personalities. Trying to skew the
it's just another hat you wore to help your company succeed, right?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, just you earlier in the interview rattled off 10 or 12 things. I told you I was exhausted listening to all the things you've got to be great at, right? And it's one of the things that makes entrepreneurship fun but also really challenging. We need to wrap up, but as we record this, Thanksgiving's right around the corner. It seems like every couple Thanksgivings, you recruit a couple additional family members and start a business. What's next for Reed Quinn?
Well, I'm working on a venture called Spark Innovation, which is a little bit different than the previous ventures. It's every time that we build these businesses, it takes a lot of work to kind of get to scale. And then somebody comes in and purchases half of the business or all of the business, and sometimes they're strategic or financial investor, but a lot of times there are things that we value highly that maybe are redundant with their business model. They already have their accounting system, and so they don't need to run that in parallel. They might have their own fulfillment system, and so this fulfillment system that we've worked really hard to create just goes to waste. And so with Spark, what we've done is we've created kind of an umbrella company that has a lot of these, a lot of the infrastructure in place. And we've started to plug a lot of fun brands, a lot of companies in Utah that have great products ideas, but maybe not quite the retail distribution or experience. And we've begun to kind of plug them into this Spark Innovation model. We're really excited about that.
Interesting. That's actually makes a lot of sense. Any names that maybe folks here in Utah have heard of that are working through that model?
We have a brand called Blade Electronics. We have one called Screen Mint, Wall Doctor. We're looking at a bunch of others that are coming along maybe in a few months. We'll have some more to report that are some up-and-coming Utah businesses in home automation, consumer products, in fragrances, in some sporting goods products, just a real fun mix.
I love that, and it's a great note for us to wrap on. You know, you've built several successful companies. Now you're extending that and helping other entrepreneurs build their business by doing something like this. It's not a wholly altruistic venture. It sounds like it's, you know, you take an ownership stake, you win when they win. But you know what? The Utah ecosystem, the easier we can make it for folks to do some of these things, these platform, these foundational things that need to be done, I think everybody benefits. So I'm really glad to hear that's what you're up to next. Reed, thanks for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Well, thank you.
Our guest this morning has been Reed Quinn, serial entrepreneur and founder of KT Tape and FiberFix. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear my entire interview with Reed on our website, kcpw.org. You can tweet me, nicely please, at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.